That brings us to the final chapter of the unit, keeping in mind that lecture examination 2 is less than a week away. So we'll finish up the unit with this chapter, and this one is about membrane structure and function. Now, by membrane here, we're back to the microscopic version of membrane, which, as you see in the opening slide, and we've been through this many times before already, is made out of a phospholipid bilayer. Is that a question?
Yeah. When is the next test?
Well, all the test dates are listed on the lecture schedule, which is on the last page of the syllabus, but they're also listed on the assignment schedule page of Canvas. And so what I meant by less than a week is that it's half hour less than a week. We have one more lecture after this. So don't forget your Scantrons on Monday. A phospholipid bilayer, remember, is automatically self-assembled when phospholipids are in the presence of water. So each individual phospholipid here is its own molecule. They are not bonded to each other chemically. They are still individual molecules, but they take on this bilayer shape simply because that way the tails, which are hydrophobic, water-fearing, because they are made out of carbon and hydrogen, right? They're hydrocarbon tails. What are the tails, molecularly speaking? What make up the tails? They are fatty acids, correct. So this is not a fat, not a triglyceride, it's a phospholipid. Instead of having three fatty acid tails, it has two. But fatty acids are the same as in a fat. They are, except for that carboxyl end, all the rest of the fatty acid is nothing but carbons and hydrogens, which are two elements that have almost the same electronegativity, and that's why hydrocarbons are nonpolar. Well, the corresponding word for nonpolar is hydrophobic. Nonpolar things don't like to be around polar things, including water. So they arrange themselves in a bilayer, the phospholipids do, because the tails then are not exposed to either the exterior or interior water. They're only by other fellow hydrophobic or nonpolar tails. And the heads are where they want to be, around water in both cases. Each of these two layers, by the way, the whole thing is a bilayer. Each single layer is a monolayer. And so one membrane is made up of a bilayer, simply because of the fact that a phospholipid is polar on one end and nonpolar on the other. What's the word that describes such a situation? What kind of molecules are phospholipids based on the fact that they are polar and nonpolar?
Amphipathic,
correct. Having dual preference. One end prefers to be around polar things, the other end, the tails, prefer to be around nonpolar things. And so this forms with no life at all. This is how the first cell-like structures came into place. You can still do this today. Just put a bunch of phospholipids in water. They'll form little bags. Nothing is alive, but it's a very cell-like structure. And those were already accumulating in the environment before any life occurred. But a true cell, a living cell, can't have its membrane made out of only phospholipids, because this is a barrier, not a barrier to everything, but a barrier to certain things, specifically things that don't want to be around those tails. They'll be locked on one side or the other. Well, some of those things need to be able to get into or out of cells in order for the cell to be alive. So that's why a living cell can't have a plasma membrane made out of nothing but phospholipids. It's certain things need to get through, and that's why a living cell has a plasma membrane made of a phospholipid substructure, as you see in slide 2. Most of it is phospholipid, but also embedded in that arrangement of phospholipids are various other things, including proteins of different sorts. All of these purple things are proteins. And just like the phospholipids are not connected to each other, they're just staying by each other, the proteins in a plasma membrane are also not connected to the phospholipids. So what keeps the proteins there? Well, remember what a protein or a polypeptide is. A polypeptide is a ribbon, right? A long strand of amino acids, each of which has an R group, but there are different categories of R groups, right? Some amino acids are polar, some of them are nonpolar, some of them are charged. If you think of that as a stretched out ribbon, it's just a sequence of amino acids. But remember, it's going to fold up into three-dimensional shape based on the interactions between those R groups. Well, here in a transmembrane protein, which is a protein that sticks all the way through the surface, through the thickness of the phospholipid bilayer, you don't see the detail of that ribbon here. It just looks like a purple glob, but it is a sequence of amino acids. And so there's R groups for each of those amino acids. There is an R group for each amino acid. And in this central region of the protein, all of those R groups are nonpolar, which makes them have no problem being around these also nonpolar tails. The R groups for the amino acids at the tips of the protein are polar, and they have no problem being around the polar heads or the water. All right? And that is what keeps it there. If you imagine trying to push this thing through the membrane, it doesn't matter which direction you do that in, you're going to expose polar R groups of the protein at one end, if you push it deep enough, to this nonpolar environment where the fatty acid tails are, and it's not going to like that, right? You're also going to expose nonpolar parts to the polar heads as you move this thing downward in the picture. So you can do that a little bit. If you let go, in other words, it's going to pop right back into its original position, kind of like moving magnets, you know, that repel each other because of polarity repelling each other in magnets. Here it's unlike chemical nature repelling each other, polar and nonpolar. Slide 3. If you use a special technique to freeze fracture, as it's called, a plasma membrane, you freeze it so it's solid, and then you break the two monolayers apart, you can see that there are proteins associated with both monolayers, but when you separate the two monolayers and then take individual photographs of them, like you see on the right, you see that there's a lot more proteins associated with the internal monolayer, the layer that's in contact with the interior of the cell, than there are associated with the exterior of the cell. And that makes sense because a lot of those proteins need to interact with things inside the cell in order to perform certain functions. So it's not surprising. But there's also things that are facing outward for important reasons, and we'll look at some of those examples. All right, so slide 4 brings back this concept I was telling you about, in which a phospholipid bilayer, well, an entire plasma membrane, not just the phospholipid bilayer, but that's what we're looking at here, is made up of individual molecules that remain individual molecules. They are not covalently bonded to each other. That means the phospholipids that make up one monolayer are kind of like a crowd of people. They're not connected to each other. They're free to move around in that layer. Right? Here you see an edge view. But imagine looking at this from above, where you'd be looking down on all these polar heads. That would be just like looking down on a crowd of people from a tall building. And if you did that over time, they would not stay in the same positions, right? Because they're not connected to each other. They remain in the layer, because they're all on the street, but they can change places. That's what's happening with phospholipids in a monolayer. And this is described by what's called the fluid mosaic model. Of plasma membrane structure. Well, what is that? What outside of biology, what is a mosaic? Yeah, it's an artwork. A mosaic is some sort of artwork in which instead of using paint applied on a surface, you use little objects, little pieces of glass or little pieces of tile, whatever, that are glued to a surface. And each one is like a pixel. And together they make up some sort of image. That's a mosaic. So the individual phospholipids are kind of like individual pieces of tile in a mosaic. Fluid means able to flow. A fluid is either a gas or a liquid. Fluid does not necessarily mean liquid, by the way. They're not. Fluid means liquid or gas. It means non-solid. Because solids are held in place. But either a gas or a liquid, those particles are changing places. They're fluid. So fluid mosaic means exactly what this crowd of people analogy means. They're able to change places. And at the top of this figure, you might be surprised at how often that happens. This lateral movement, meaning phospholipids in the same monolayer trading places. That happens about 10 million times per second in each of your cells. So this is just part of the fact that cells are not static, unchanging devices. They're continuously changing. They're highly dynamic. Not just the membrane, but also the interior. But certainly the membrane is. And it should make sense that this is easy because they are not connected to each other. And if they do trade places, that doesn't expose any polar to nonpolar, right? It's still keeping all the tails around other tails and not exposed to water. On the other hand, you also every once in a while have flip-flops. That's one phospholipid in one monolayer trading places with a phospholipid in the other monolayer. And the reason that is rare is because doing that will temporarily, at least during the flip-flop, expose the head, which is polar, to this interior thickness, which is nonpolar. And that's why it happens only about once a month. The second row of this slide discusses membrane fluidity, which is how fluid the membrane is. How loose it is or how tight it is, really, is what the fluidity refers to. And that can change depending on the environment. Right? For instance, if the temperature drops, everything's going to get tighter. Everything's going to tend to move slower. And that might not be appropriate, right? Because there has to be a certain amount of fluidity for the cell to remain alive. So a cell needs to be able to adjust the fluidity of its membrane in response to environmental changes to keep it fluid. Keep it at the right fluidity. Too much is bad, too little is bad. And so if it gets too cold and it tightens up, it can increase the fluidity to make it loose again by changing the types of phospholipids that are part of the membrane itself. When we talked about fats or triglycerides, which are similar because they have fatty acid tails as well, we talked about the fact that there are different kinds of fatty acids. Right? Any individual fatty acid is either saturated or unsaturated, right? And the saturated ones, which are saturated with hydrogens because there are no double bonds between carbons, have a straightness to them, which allows them to pack together more tightly. That means less loose in terms of the membrane. So if the things tighten up too much because it gets too cold, for instance, then the cell can respond by taking out some of these saturated phospholipids that pack together tightly and replacing them with unsaturated phospholipids, ones that have unsaturated fatty acids and therefore kinks in them, and that allows for more space between them. It's a looser membrane. On the other hand, it can get too loose, right? If the temperature goes the other direction, gets too warm, it's going to be too loose, and therefore it can do just the opposite. It can make its membrane out of only saturated phospholipids, which will pack together much more. The bottom shows you cholesterol as a component of membranes. Well, that's true for animal cells. Animals produce cholesterol. Other organisms produce other sterols, like plants produce phytosterols, and fungi produce ergosterols. But for us animals, cholesterol is important for all the other reasons I discussed, as the precursor for all the steroid hormones and for vitamin D. But it also, cholesterol is also an important plasma membrane component. It kind of fills in gaps here and there. And so it also affects the fluidity, but also the permeability, how well things can go through the membrane. Okay, so this slide 5 gives you the results of an experiment to test whether the fluid mosaic model is true. Fluid mosaic model tells you that all of the components of the membrane are continuously moving around, changing places. To test this, they took a cell from two different organisms, a human and a mouse, and each of those cells, of course, has various proteins embedded in the membrane, but they're different kinds of proteins. And so they used chemical methods to label these. They weren't actually magenta and purple, but they were labeled in a way so that they could tell where those proteins are at any given moment. They can detect them. And then they fused the two cells together into one hybrid cell. Now, at the moment that they fused them together, of course, all of the mouse cell proteins, the magenta ones, are going to be on one side, and all the human proteins are going to be on the other side. And if the fluid mosaic model were not true, then you would expect that situation to stay the same, right? There wouldn't be any movement of those proteins. They would stay polarized, all mouse on one end, all human on the other end. But if the fluid mosaic model is actually true, then you would expect exactly what they observed. After a while, there was movement of both types of proteins away from where they're concentrated, and so it's an overall mixture of the two. They're switching places continuously. Okay, I guess I didn't tell you about transmembrane proteins when I thought I did earlier. That's shown in this slide, slide 6. This is a picture that shows all kinds of different proteins, because you have proteins inside the cell that are part of the cytoskeleton that you see here. There are proteins that you see outside that are part of the extracellular matrix. Well, those aren't the proteins we're talking about. I've already talked about the strain relief in a different slide. We're concerning ourselves, though, with these proteins that are actually part of the membrane. And so this brings up those two phrases I talked about early on in the term: membrane-bounded and membrane-bound, right? These proteins are membrane-bound proteins. That does not mean enclosed by a membrane. That means tied to a membrane. So these proteins are actually part of the membrane. Every one of these pictured is a membrane-bound protein. They do different jobs, and they're bound to the membrane for various reasons that we'll look at it in a minute. But there are two major categories of membrane-bound proteins based simply on how they are connected to the membrane. There are what are called peripheral proteins, which a couple of them are labeled here. They don't necessarily have to be on the inner layer, like they are in this case. They could be on the outer layer. But a peripheral protein is so called because the periphery is the edge of something. A peripheral protein does not extend into the thickness of the plasma membrane. It's just connected to one surface or the other, the interior surface or the exterior surface. So it's really only associated with polar heads, as you see in this cartoon. Okay, that's a peripheral protein. It's still part of the membrane. It's just not sticking through the thickness. The ones that do stick through the thickness, and I don't mean necessarily all the way through. I just mean into at least some of the depth of the thickness. So it's exposed to the tails as well as heads. Those are collectively called integral proteins. And unfortunately, this picture doesn't show you that there are, doesn't label two different kinds of integral proteins. Every one of these integral proteins pokes all the way through the thickness, right? But that doesn't have to be the case. You can imagine half of this. It's going through half of the thickness. It's associated with tails, not just the heads. So it would still be integral. Integral means simply not peripheral. It goes through the thickness at least to a certain degree. Then there's a special category of integral proteins that do extend all the way through the thickness. In other words, the same protein will have part of itself exposed to the exterior extracellular fluid and part exposed to the intracellular fluid because it goes all the way through the thickness. That's still an integral protein, but more specifically, it is a transmembrane protein. Trans meaning across the membrane, across the thickness. All right, so that's a special case of integral proteins. On the exterior surface, you can see here and there, there are various sugars. These green things made of hexagons are polysaccharides of various sorts. And some of them are connected directly to phospholipids. The sugars are connected directly to the phospholipids. And therefore, we call that combination of sugar and lipid a glycolipid. Glyco means sugar. Other sugars are connected directly to membrane-bound proteins, and therefore those are called glycoproteins. And the sugar component of these, which faces outward, serve more or less as little ID badges. In a multicellular organism like we are, all animals, it's really important for however many cells there are in the body of that organism to recognize each other as part of the same individual as opposed to a potential enemy, a potential pathogen. So those little sugar badges say to the other cells of the same organism, I'm with you, I'm part of the same individual. All right, 7. Well, a tiny little slice of plasma membrane is shown here with just one protein in place, and this happens to be a transmembrane protein. Now, does this protein have quaternary structure? It's a boring part of the recording. How do you can tell whether a protein has quaternary structure? What does that mean? That's right, multiple polypeptides, which in the ribbon model would mean multiple ribbons, right? Well, you have only one ribbon here. It's a long ribbon that winds back and forth through the thickness many times, but it's all one polypeptide. So no, this is not a multimeric protein. This is just single polypeptide. But notice all of these alpha helices, which is part of secondary structure that we talked about. Each alpha helix is arranged as the stave or the vertical wood piece of a barrel in a cylinder, basically. So it's hollow. The hollow interior is right here. So this protein is embedded in the membrane for the purpose of being a transport protein, allowing things that can't get directly through the phospholipid bilayer either into or out of the cell. That's just one of the function of membrane-bound proteins, but it's an important function. That's why I was saying earlier that a living cell can't have plasma membrane made out of only phospholipids. It needs transport proteins in there to get necessary things into or out of the cell. Well, that's one major function of membrane-bound proteins, but slide 8 gives you 6 major categories of functions for membrane-bound proteins. Transport is shown first. That's what we just talked about. And we'll talk about various transport mechanisms in detail later, but anything that needs to get into or out of a cell but that cannot get directly through the phospholipid bilayer because it doesn't like being around those tails needs the help of a transport protein. And transport protein can operate to let things into or out of. The direction isn't specified. Okay, that happens different ways that we'll talk about, but that's one major category. Next up is enzymatic activity as a function. We've talked a little bit about enzymes, and we'll talk more about them in the next unit, the hard part of the course. But keep in mind what is true of enzymes. All enzymes are catalysts, chemically speaking. And a catalyst is some substance that speeds up a reaction, not by operating as a reactant, because a reactant will get changed into product, right? An enzyme or any catalyst doesn't get used up. It just helps reactants turn into products. So it speeds the reaction up. And there are thousands of different enzymes working in your cells because you have thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions, and each kind of chemical reaction has its own specific kind of enzyme that will work with that kind of reaction, which is why a huge part of your genome, huge number of your total genes, is used for instructions for how to build enzymes. Well, most of those enzymes are working as catalysts fully inside the cell. But some of them are actually enzymes that are bound to the membrane as well. It doesn't really change anything. It's still acting as an enzyme, so it still has an active site, which allows for binding of a substrate that gets turned into product. It just happens to be doing it while it's part of the membrane. Next up is signal transduction. To transduce, the verb form of transduction, means to change from one form to another. For example, a loudspeaker is a transducer because it changes or transduces an AC electrical signal coming through the speaker cable into motion of the cone, which pushes on the air and we perceive it as sound. That's transduction. Here we're looking at signal transduction in a cell, which is a change in messages from the original message to a so-called secondary message and so on until something actually happens, the end result in the cell. Well, this involves signal molecules, which we talked about already, right? Signal molecules are simply particles that act as signals and that therefore cause things to happen in a cell that would not happen if the signal were not present. But remember what else I told you about signals, which is that no signal can have any effect at all unless and until it binds to a receptor that has the right shape to receive that particular signal. Well, hormones are examples of signals, for instance, and hormones come in 2 major chemical categories. Most of the hormones are amino acid based, the so-called protein hormones. And those are too big to actually get through the membrane, the plasma membrane, and enter the cell. A smaller number are the lipid based hormones. All the steroid hormones are made out of cholesterol. That's a lipid, right? Well, lipids don't have any problem at all being around these phospholipid tails, because that's the lipid component of the phospholipid. They are nonpolar. So the steroid hormones can slip right through a membrane, enter the cell. Well, they're signals no matter which of those two categories, so they have to have a receptor. But the point here is that the receptors for lipid-based hormones are found inside the cell because the hormone can easily enter the cell. Protein hormones, though, have to have their receptors located on the exterior surface of a cell because they can't get into the cell. And therefore, if the receptor were inside the cell, there would be no effect because you have to have a binding of the signal to the receptor itself. Well, imagine this purple protein that's acting as the receptor not sticking all the way through. It does, but let's say it doesn't. So let's say it sticks halfway through. It's an integral protein, but not transmembrane. It would still receive the signal, right? But the cell would never know that's happening. What is the general consequence, by the way, of a ligand, which a signal is an example of, binding to a protein? What happens whenever a ligand, many examples of ligands, binds to a protein? What does?
Receptor?
Yes, which is a protein. It's not necessarily a receptor. There's many examples of the protein. So like an enzyme is also a protein that binds to a ligand called the substrate. Anyway, in any case of a ligand binding to a protein, the general consequence is a conformational change in the protein, a change in shape, in other words. So if this were only poking halfway through, yes, the signal would bind, and that would cause a shape change in the protein, but nothing inside the cell would know that's happening because it just changes the shape of a protein that's facing outward, right? So in signal transduction, this has to be a transmembrane protein. Otherwise, the signal wouldn't be transduced. When the signal comes along and binds to the receptor surface, which is facing outward where the signal is, the shape change of the protein is such that even the part of the protein, the receptor protein, that faces inward changes shape. And therefore, it can interact with this little purple thing, for example, which it wouldn't be able to because the shape isn't correct until that happens. And that would be the second messenger. This is like handing off a note to someone else. The original signal's job is done. It doesn't enter the cell, but the signal is transduced by relaying it off to a second messenger, and there can be a third messenger. Several things can happen in sequence, and then eventually you have the ultimate effect of the signal that happens inside the cell. Okay, and cell-to-cell recognition is another category. This is what I was talking about earlier when I likened the sugars to little ID badges. So you have two different proteins involved. One is a glycoprotein. The protein is keeping it in the membrane, but the glyco part of it is the sugar acting as the ID badge. But you have another protein in a membrane of a different cell with just the right shape to recognize that particular ID badge, and that's when it says, okay, you're one of us. A very similar thing is in E, intercellular joining, except this is not for the purpose of recognizing cells, it's for the purpose of holding them together. So this is exactly how a desmosome, as I described it, works. It's for the purpose of keeping the two cells hooked together. And the strain relief thing that I talked about earlier is shown in F. Some transmembrane proteins connect simultaneously to proteins in the extracellular matrix and proteins in the cytoskeleton, and therefore the force of pulling is transmitted through the transmembrane protein to the cytoskeleton without damaging the plasma membrane. Slide 9. All of the stuff that's shown here we've really talked about already in the tour of the cell slide. The only new information is something that I was trying to describe in words, but you didn't get a good picture of. I said that the Golgi complex has the job of figuring out where a package of proteins needs to go. Sometimes it needs to go out of the cell completely. sometimes those proteins need to be part of the plasma membrane, so not completely exported, but put into the plasma membrane. Well, remember how we talked about vesicles being made out of membrane, and when membrane contacts more membrane material, they just fuse together. So membrane material is continuously being moved around from plasma membrane to other membrane-bounded organelles. You can see vesicles budding off of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, becoming part of the Golgi. New vesicles are bubbling off of the Golgi. And now notice, here's where the new information is. Notice that this particular vesicle has various proteins in it, but it's containing them two different ways. Some of those proteins are completely inside the vesicle, but this one that appears like a dumbbell is not inside the vesicle. It is actually bound to the vesicular membrane, right? It's part of that membrane. So when this vesicle fuses to the plasma membrane and just becomes part of the plasma membrane, the proteins that were fully inside the vesicle get spilled all the way outside. But the ones that are embedded in the membrane of the vesicle itself will now become part of the plasma membrane instead of being fully exported. And so that's what the Golgi has to figure out, whether these go all the way out or stay as part of the plasma membrane. All right, now, you guys have lab today, right? No quiz today? Yes, there is a quiz today. In lab, I'm going to talk about slides 10, 11, and 12, so I'm not going to talk about them here. But 10, 11, and 12 are part of the slideshow, and therefore they are part of the lecture material for the test. It's just I'm going to be delivering that little piece of lecture downstairs. I can't fit it in up here, but it is part of lecture, and therefore part of the lecture exam. It will also, though, be part of the lab material. So those three slides, that stuff I talk about in a separate recording, will be both for the lecture and for the lab. Everyone clear on that? Okay, let's skip over them though and go to 13. That's kind of unfortunate because usually I do those first, but since we did the saltwater thing because of the holiday basically, we're you're behind my other sections. You're just now getting around this week to doing the things that my other sections did in lab last week. But anyway, in 13 we have a picture of a single-celled organism. This happens to be a protist, which sometimes people use to mean unicellular eukaryote. That's not what it means. Its meaning has changed throughout the years, but protist now is kind of an informal grouping that means any eukaryotic organism that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. Okay, so anything other than a eukaryote definitely is not a protist. It's right. It's a prokaryote. Bacteria and archaea are the prokaryotes. If you know that you have a eukaryotic organism you're looking at, then that can be an animal, a plant, or a fungus. Those are all eukaryotes, but there are other eukaryotes besides those three, including algae and various other things. So those things collectively, the eukaryotes that aren't animal, plant, or fungus, are called prokaryotes. And some of them are unicellular, like this one we're looking at. But some of them are huge, like they're giant brown algae as big as trees. Those are all, since they're not animals, plants, or fungi, those are also protists. This is a unicellular protist, though, and even more specifically, it is an aqueous protist. What does the word aqueous mean? It means water, yeah. So does marine. What is the distinction between aquatic and marine? Well, so is aquatic. They both live in water. But the words are used differently. No. Well, I mean, yes, technically it does. But it means involving water somehow. But an aqueous environment is fresh water, whereas a marine environment is salt water. Rivers, lakes, and streams, fresh water. Ocean is salt water, obviously. And those are totally different environments, especially when we get around to talking about those three slides I just skipped over, which I'll talk about later today. The point here is that when a cell lives in a freshwater environment, there is a continuous tendency, for reasons I'll explain downstairs, for water to enter the cell. Mainly because the environment is more watery than the cell. So water is going to be coming in all the time. And this particular protist is like our own cells, like animal cells in general, which means that they do not have a cell wall in addition to the plasma membrane. The only thing it has is a plasma membrane, which is a pretty flimsy device. Can't hold the pressure in. So if there's continuously water coming in, that would explode the cell. Well, if you lose a cell, no big deal. You lose billions every day. And you create billions to replace them every day. No big deal. But if you are a single-celled organism and you lose a cell, that's the end of you. That is a big deal. So this creature has evolved a way to deal with the fact that water is continuously coming in. It has an organelle called a contractile vacuole, which is another use of the word vacuole, basically what looks like an empty sac made out of membrane. But it has these microfilaments, the same microfilaments that are used in our muscle cells, that allow this vacuole, once it fills up with enough water, stretches enough, to contract, squeeze itself, basically, and push that water out. So it's just doing that continuously, like a bilge pump, pumping out water to keep this thing from exploding. I think I'll make this the last slide, even if I have a couple of minutes left. It's a pretty good place to stop. I talked about transport proteins already. That's one of those six major functions of membrane-bound proteins. They are proteins that act somehow, they do it various ways, they act to help transport things either into or out of the cell. They allow passage, I should say, of things through the plasma membrane that are not able to get directly through the phospholipid part of the plasma membrane. And there's two major reasons why something could not get directly through the phospholipid bilayer. One is it's simply too big. Like the protein hormones I was talking about earlier, they're just too big. Proteins are large molecules. Another reason, though, is a particle might be too polar, either polar or beyond polar, which is fully charged. Ions, for instance, are fully charged, right? A hydrogen ion is tiny. It's just a single proton, right? So it's plenty small enough, but it has a full charge. So it does not want to be around this non-charged, non-polar thickness where the tails are. And so any particle that is either too large or too charged or a combination of the two cannot effectively get through that phospholipid bilayer. Yes, there will be a little bit of leakage, but they're largely excluded. It's a boundary for passage. And a lot of those things need to be able to get into and out of cells. So that's why you need transport proteins. Well, this slide shows you that there are two categories of transport proteins based simply on how they allow the passage of the particles. There are what are called channel proteins. The top cartoon is a channel protein shown in cutaway view. So you can see that it has a hollow tunnel interior. It would be, you wouldn't really see it if it were wrapped all the way around in three dimensions, but it's a cutaway view. And a tunnel is a tunnel, meaning that if there is a particle that is the right size and type that can get through that tunnel, it will go through the tunnel. All right, that's a channel protein. Now, there are such things as channel proteins that have gates that can open and close, but the tunnel itself does not change shape. So channel proteins do not change conformation when they operate. They're just there as holes through which things that can't get through otherwise can get through. The other major category, though, shown on the bottom are carrier proteins. And a carrier protein is a transport protein that does operate by changing conformation or changing shape. Notice that in this bottom example, it has a certain shape to begin with, which allows for temporary binding of this yellow thing, whatever it is, some sort of particle. That's a ligand binding to a protein, so the general consequence is a shape change, right? In this case, the shape change is such that it will open up to the interior and therefore drop off that solute particle to the interior of the cell. It could operate in exactly the opposite direction. This is just one example. But in any case of a carrier protein, it's going to change shape in order to allow the thing to pass. And that's where I'll stop. I'll see you in a little bit.